Good evening, everyone. My name is Karen Giussone, and I'm the Helen Bernstein Librarian for Periodicals. And it's my real pleasure to welcome you all here tonight on behalf of the New York Public Library to Periodically Speaking. We absolutely love hosting this event and working with the Council of Literary Magazines and Presses. It gives us an opportunity to put literary magazines front and center and to give emerging writers an opportunity to a place to read new work and to also hear from editors about their journal. So I want to encourage you all to support literary magazines. One of the ways, of course, is to subscribe, but also to come back and check out the library's collection. We have a wonderful collection, so I encourage you to do that. And also, one of the things I want to quickly mention about that collection and to ensure that that collection stays strong and to also ensure that the library stays open, we have flyers in the back. This is what it looks like. The library is facing some budget cuts this year, so I encourage you to check out the flyers and write a letter, write an email to City Council to show your support, and so we can make sure that things like this, like Periodically Speaking, continues to happen. Just a couple other things. We have another event that we're really excited about on May 30th here, which is the Magathon, another event that we collaborate with CLMP on. And that will be on Saturday, May 30th, from 4 to 6 o'clock. And at that event, we showcase about 25 literary magazines and their editors for a rolling reading that goes on for about 2.5 hours. It's a lot of fun. So if you haven't come, I encourage you to try to make it. And the other thing is to check out our podcasts, which are now available at nypl.org. We've got about the last 2 years. So if you go to the library's website, you can hear the readings there, and you can hear tonight's reading there next week. So thank you to Tasha Sorensen at CLMP, who's doing a great job on curating Periodically Speaking, and she's really been wonderful to work with. And lastly, you're all invited to stay around after for refreshments, which will be outside in the hall. So enjoy the evening, and now it's a real pleasure to introduce Tasha Sorensen, who will introduce the program tonight. Thank you all for coming.
Hello, it's great to see you all back, if we've never seen you before. Thanks for coming. So a few quick words about CLMP. For over 40 years, we've been helping independent literary publishers navigate the business of publishing. We exist to help those presses and magazines who are the ones who do all the heavy lifting of getting the literature to you, but we help them do all the unsexy parts, marketing, subscriptions, accounting, etc. There's more about that on this great card here. We currently serve over 500 independent literary publishers in America, as well as a handful overseas. And here in the Periodicals, of course, is one of the best places to learn about literary magazines. We hope that this program can provide an ample sampling of just how diverse and how surprising each publication can be. So another great way, as Karen mentioned before, to sample literary magazines is at the upcoming Literary Magathon weekend, and that's this little handy orange flyer here, which we kick off with the reading here on May 30th, and it's followed the next day, excuse me, on Sunday, May 31st, with a huge book fair at the Housing Works Cafe in SoHo. So I suppose that's it for now. And without further ado, I would like to introduce Barbara Solomon from the Reading Room.
First of all, I want to, before I introduce April, let me just tell you that there is press releases and information about the reading room back there, including a sheet that if you want to know about our upcoming events, if you just would put your email or a means of getting in touch with you, You could sign that. I do want to signal that in the fall, we are doing this very special issue where and it's in color, and there are going to be a lot of events about this at NYU, the Cervantes Institute, all over the place, because for the first time, the geniuses of Spanish literature, contemporary, post-Franco, all of whom were children during the Spanish Civil War, have been gathered in this unique volume. And they are the people that have transformed modern, contemporary Spanish writing. And we also have art and other things in it, including the position of Jewish culture in a European context, plus lighter things such as fusion flamenco, fusion bullfighting, et cetera, et cetera. So this is going to be a big, big fall thing. So just if you will sign up there, we will see that you were appraised of everything. Now, to get to the marvelous April Deller, who is Texas's gift to us. Some of Texas's gifts we haven't been so fond of, but April makes up for it. And she came from Texas and became, like other New Yorkers, an indigenous New Yorker, which is the history of this city. She graduated magna cum laude from the CUNY Baccalaureate program in Manhattan. She is a singer and a songwriter. She has performed in such venues as the Knitting Factory, Brooklyn Children's Museum, and the United Nations. In 2004, she competed, that means she was, Miss University America in the Mr. and Miss University International Pageant in Seoul, Korea. She's currently recording a music album entitled Innocence for Divine Inspiration Records. She truly has an incredible voice. So again, if you put your names down there, we will see that you get all sorts of information about April, the Reading Room, Manhattan, and now it is April's turn. I welcome April, originally from Texas.
Thank you. Okay, hi. I'm going to read a piece that I wrote 2 or 3 years ago, and it was published in Reading Room 7. That was the latest issue before this coming issue. The essay itself is written in 5 parts. I'm going to read parts 1 and 2, and if I have time, I'll go on to part 5. Okay. So the essay is called A Transformation into Womanhood, a Reflection in 5 Parts. Part 1, A Seed Among Flowers. Amen, amen, I say to you, unless a grain of wheat falls to the ground and dies, it remains just a grain of wheat, but if it dies, it produces much fruit. John 12:24. I must tell you of a most beautiful miracle that has happened to me. I'm not yet 25, nor am I dead, but I have experienced the resurrection. This resurrection is the same resurrection that all young girls experience upon the cusp of womanhood. But at the age of nearly 23, it caught me quite unawares. It is not that I had never been informed of this period of change in a young person's life, but I had been told that it would occur earlier in one's teenage years. In high school, I shrugged my shoulders and took them at their word. I accepted that inside my teenage body, there were tiny little chemicals called raging hormones racing around and causing havoc. Of course, I did not feel any particular change, so I just assumed God had given me a special grace and that my self-proclaimed high spiritual values allowed me to rise above the carnal desires I saw at work in many of my friends. Now, at the end of my delayed but arduous process towards maturity, I recognize a different type of grace responsible for such a late blossoming. I have learned to call it the grace of denial. Denial is the first stage of dying. It can come in the form of proactive disbelief or alarmed incredulity, such as exclaiming, "This can't be happening to me," while scouring for evidence to the contrary, hoping that there has been a mistake, a misunderstanding, that if you keep searching, you will soon find proof of your health and viability. Then there is the type of denial that doesn't even acknowledge the fact that a person may be dying. Nothing gets through, neither kind nor harsh words, nor in fact any words that relate to what the person wants to deny. A person in denial doesn't search for evidence to disprove assertions of death. They simply continue on about their busy days, climbing mountains, slaying dragons, and propelling through life without impediment. It is as if the words of foreboding were never spoken. And to their mind, it's true. Those words never were spoken. I was like this. I was a little seed in the ground, tightly compact and smooth all around. I was warm and comfortable, and I was quite content with the darkness surrounding me. I was a seed, and that was how I intended to stay. I had heard whispers that I would not remain a seed, but I chose to ignore them. All around me, there were seeds, too, going through a process of decay. I had no understanding of what was happening to them, and I had no interest. I was a seed. When I was a girl, I was such a strong woman. I was not fickle or petulant, but level-headed and consistent. I was not emotional or alarming, but so simple and predictable, guided by practicality and logic. I was Lady Willpower, and I was so proud. I could not understand the females around me, why they acted as they did, one day wishing for the moon and the next day a valley. I had no close girlfriends for the longest time because I felt out of place. I prided myself on being able to have straightforward, just friends relationships with all of my male acquaintances. Being one of the guys myself, it perplexed me that most women were not. I had no idea that I wasn't a woman. They say that pride comes before a fall, and in my case, this is true. On that particular night, I was standing beside a dark, cool river waiting. I was at the pinnacle of my self-assuredness. I was so relaxed, so calm. There was nothing in my inner composition that I didn't understand. I was sure of my dreams, my desires, and my abilities. My calling was matched by my determination. I had it all figured out. I knew who I was. I was a seed. What happened next, I find it difficult to describe. Even now, I am still confused by it. In my peace of mind, I heard a voice calling. In my dark shell underground, I felt a warmth emanating from above. The voice, it declared, "I wish to love the you that will become." And the warmth, it beckoned to me. I was transfixed. I couldn't move. It all seemed so wonderful. And then suddenly, violently, I was ripped through with lightning. A volcano erupted, fireworks were bursting, and there was a loud clanging in my ears. I couldn't see anything, I couldn't breathe, and I was overwhelmed with shock. I wanted to cry, but all I could do was stand there stunned. Death is the ultimate and most acute form of human loss we can experience on this earth. It is the end of the here and now and an entry into the unknown. In death, whether you like it or not, you will have to say goodbye to everything you have ever cherished. Loved ones, possessions, and your body, even your own memories cannot be taken with you. My development into womanhood was very much a sort of death for me, an inconsolable loss, a plunge into the unfathomable. I should have felt it coming, but I didn't. When it did come, I became irrepressibly angry. Blindsided, caught off guard, unprepared, I could no longer play the cool, calm, and unaffected nonchalant. I was racked with emotion, plagued with desires that I did not approve of. My skin was no longer pale and pure, but flushed red, breaking out in waves. Having lost my sense of self-control, I felt vulnerable, weak, and ashamed. I was being punished for something I didn't do, convicted of a crime I did not commit. I was suffering. When one plants a seed in the ground, it is rarely thought of how the seed must die. No one thinks about how the seed will one day rupture unexpectedly in a brutal manner. No one imagines the decay, the shriveling, and the torment that must take place. Instead, they leave the seed alone in its anguish, thinking only of the pleasure they will derive from its beauty in a few weeks' time. But the seed does not know it will be beautiful. Part 2, The Father of All Lies. And you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. John 8:32. Anger is a mysterious force, said to be the second emotional stage that a dying person experiences. It can come from two places. First, the dying individual may feel helpless in the face of death, like he no longer has a say. Second, he can become indignant at being forced to suffer an injustice he feels he does not deserve. Why me? He searches for someone or something tangible to blame, a scapegoat to stand in for the true object of his resentment, elusive death itself. He strikes out at family members, doctors, even God. He blames himself, too, searching for the interior faults and sins that have brought on such a strict judgment. It is not a matter of consolation, either. The dying person does not seek comfort. He's just plain angry. I couldn't believe it at first, but I became angry too. I hadn't escaped it after all, this terrible thing that I dreaded, womanhood. I had thought I could stay innocent and pure forever with the heart of a child, not worrying about anything or anyone, relying only on God. What I really sought was autonomy, independence, self-sufficiency, and self-rule. Womanhood was for the weak, dependent, and ruled over waif who had no free will of her own, but who was predestined to be the slave of a man. In my head, I heard the curses of God. Your urge shall be for your husband, and he shall be your master. Genesis 3:16. I grieved bitterly against myself, against my newfound susceptibility to sensual temptation. I felt I had been lured astray, enticed, and duped unfairly. I condemn myself, saying, "A woman, thy name is indeed frailty." A woman can be branded. She can be made to go stand in the corner without her face showing, while an iron is continually heated and pressed into her skin. She cannot see what the resulting images say, but she can feel the pain inflicted when they are seared onto her body. She can sense the reproach of passers-by who judge her from the rear, not even having seen her countenance. Weak, volatile, lustful, adulterous, unclean, shameful, wicked, disobedient. She does not know that a multitude more defamations than these reside on her backside. As a little girl, this was the impression of womanhood passed on to me. I didn't actually know a woman of these characteristics personally. My mother was the opposite, tough, unemotional, faithful, and most of all, fruitful. She bore 8 children within a span of 18 years. But women as a whole were regarded as trivial and flippant, not deserving of much esteem or consideration. I watched as my mother purposely disdained the outward characteristics of other women. She refused to wear makeup, to color or curl her hair in the latest women's fashion, or to prance about in high heels and feminine dresses. Jeans and t-shirts were her uniform. She lifted weights to become muscular and buff. Her hands were thick and meaty with fingernails unadorned, and the scars and scratches of manual labor were on her arms. No one could say my mother was soft. Oppression requires an authority that uses force unjustly. Individuals under the yoke of oppression are kept down and subjugated, their freedom taken away. Their power is invalidated, canceled, made null and void. If they rebel, they are punished cruelly, the victims of bullying and compulsion. After a time, as a means of survival, the subjugated may begin to accept the propaganda that attempts to rationalize their mistreatment. and this internalized oppression no longer requires the presence of an authority. The conquered have learned to oppress themselves. They now know how to have faith in lies. Falsehood abounds. It is difficult to know the truth if you believe in lies. Lies paint an aura of fear where there is liberty, and fear is a strong motivator. It aims to keep wanderers moving backwards and away, and it sketches a terrible picture of harsh and jagged lines. When you are frightened, moving backwards and away can seem like your best and most basic survival mechanism, but there is a major problem with traveling in reverse. You can't see where you are going. Soon you find yourself in a deep hole, even scarier than the one you were moving away from. But clinging to lies, you believe you are safe. I saw that woman with marks on her back when I was a little girl once. The stories I had been told about her imprinted my mind with a prejudice. Stumbling upon her from behind, I was horrified at seeing her mutilation. Terrified, I backed away. I felt no sorrow or empathy for her pain. I could not see the beautiful eyes that cried on the other side of that wall of mangled flesh. I did not want to help her. I just did not want to be her. At the age of 23, I still believed all the propaganda telling me that women deserved everything they got. If a woman suffered, surely she had done something to warrant it. It was her nature that was the problem, unstable and unpredictable as it was. She brought it on herself. At 23, I still disassociated myself from that known as woman. I fought to retain my thin, girlish figure to appear sexless. I suppressed my emotions, wanting to be tough, stoic, and rational like a man. But at the age of 23, I found all of my hard work lying in ruins. My best defense mechanism was laid bare and exposed for the great hoax that it was. I had sided with the oppressor in an attempt to evade oppression. In truth, I was just a woman, defeated by the most ironic conqueror of all. Believing in lies, I had learned to oppress myself. Okay, and I'm going to start on section 5 now. Section 5 is kind of like the positive resolution, so I'm skipping to it. A brave, bold butterfly. My grace is sufficient for you, for power is made perfect in weakness. 2 Corinthians 12:9. I have now learned to stop seeking divinity. I now understand the beauty of being mortal, of being corruptible. I am content with who I am, because really, there is no such thing as guilt. I am grateful that I stumbled on that stone, which dashed me into a million pieces. I am glad that I suffered, that I was humbled, that I became a body full of desires. Because now I see how it was that the Word became flesh. Acceptance is the final stage in the process of dying. During depression, the dying seek to reconcile the past, to put the final touches on their unfinished business with God, themselves, and others. They struggle to love themselves in spite of weakness. But when acceptance comes, there is finally peace. The dying person is able to say yes to death, not with a sense of sadness, but with a calm hope and tranquility. They are ready to be embraced by the mysterious. There is a beautiful treasure in the power a woman has to say yes to a loss of autonomy. If one notices closely, the secret to all eternity lies in the body of a woman. It is veiled in the physical changes she endures throughout her natural lifetime, in the growth from adolescence to maturity, in the consummation of marriage, in pregnancy and motherhood. Even in menopause, the body of a woman is continually made powerless. Her flesh is consumed, molded, and transformed, all so that others might share in the fullness of life. It is our miracle. The nature of death is somewhat unknown, but those who have returned from so-called near-death experiences, who were declared clinically dead before being revived back to life, have related similar accounts from the realm beyond. They report that they have a new body, beautiful and glorious in its perfection. As they float above the room, they can see their old body, dead and lifeless below. They feel weightless, completely without pain, and at total peace. Those who were blind in the natural world can suddenly see. Later, upon being revived, they can give detailed descriptions of events that proceeded while they were dead. They can report who came in and out of the room. They can describe the color and pattern on their doctor's tie. Those who were missing limbs find their new body made whole. Even those who could not know they had lost arms or legs, those who had died instantly in an automobile accident, for example, can describe the scene of the crash, the injuries sustained, and the places where emergency personnel had discovered their dismembered parts. It is not just wishful thinking that causes the dead to imagine themselves possessing what their mortal bodies had lacked. They really are unbroken. There is all the evidence in the world to believe in the resurrection. Day after day, darkness comes upon the earth, and in the morning the sun rises to shine again. Year after year, the seasons exchange the bounty of the soil for a wasteland that in the springtime flourishes with life anew. Century after century, generations pass away while new ones are delivered. There is not one who has not witnessed the transforming powers of creation, but who has believed? I have often experienced faith as a paradox. If God is a God of love and peace, how can there be so much suffering in the world? If God is a God of justice, why do the wicked prosper and the innocent perish? In this kingdom of flesh and mortality, just who is in charge? Now, through my transformation into womanhood, my faith is incarnate, meaning I have come to know God in my flesh. I have experienced a God who loves, not apart from frailty, suffering, and death, but through and in spite of it. Some say that God is not a God who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses. For there is a testimony that at one time God emptied himself and became an outward bearing like a man. Like a mortal, he suffered and became obedient unto death, even death on a cross. I am a free woman. I tell myself that often now. I tell myself that I am loved and that I am beautiful. I look in the mirror and smile. I am overjoyed. I no longer condemn myself, judge myself, criticize myself, nor do I listen to the voices of brokenheartedness. I know that even in my imperfection, I have no cause to feel guilty. I have long ago been redeemed. A woman is just one living testimony to the power of transformation. The chick hatching from its shattered shell is another. The flower blossoming from its rotted seed is one more. 20 minutes. Do you want me to continue then? It's over. Okay. The rest is in here. Thank you.
Okay, so if you'd like to hear the conclusion to that, pick up Reading Room 7 or come back to the library and check it out. So the best way to make sure that your favorite magazines stick around is to subscribe to them. So if one of the publications tonight strikes your fancy, please support them by subscribing to ensure that each month, each quarter, each year, you'll get more great literature. Now, it's been said that without independent literary publishing, there wouldn't be any poetry in America. While there certainly would be many people writing poetry, we're not sure how easy it would be to distribute and read it. So we're very happy to introduce our next selection. Philip Freed with the Manhattan Review.
Is the voice projecting? I'm going to first give first want to thank the library and CLMP, two of my favorite institutions, for making this possible. I think it's a wonderful event. And I'd want to give a brief sketch of the Manhattan Review and then introduce poet Ian Brand. I founded the Manhattan Review in 1980, and I thought I would do it for a little while. It just became addictive, and so I'm still doing it, and I'm still enjoying it. The key thing about it for me is finding new voices, writers both here in the United States and in the United Kingdom, and in translated work from around the world. I still find that the most exciting part of the publication, sort of reaching out and getting something in the mail that's really exciting. It's kind of like the hunter's instinct. It's the instinct for acquisition. And that's what still makes it worthwhile after 30 years. And we've gone through many incarnations. We had an interview series with A.R. Ammons, Zbigniew Herbert, and Thomas Kinsella, people like that. And now we have a section called Poetry on Prose, which consists of many reviews and interesting essays on poetry. We try to relate poetry to popular culture. We had an essay on Bob Dylan and Thomas Hardy, the poet, right? Thank you. To try to relate popular culture to more traditional culture. And we also had a very good essay on the Holocaust, translation of Holocaust poetry. And we're having, we try to sponsor events both here and in Britain. We had a launch of our latest issue at the Library Book Culture near Columbia, and also in the Oxfam book shop at Marylebone High Street in England, where we had a feature on young British poets who had started publishing since 2003. On November 2nd, and you can find out about this by going to our website at themanhattanreview.com and also subscribe there. We're having a big event with many interesting poets from England at KGB Bar on Monday, November 2nd. This brings me to, we always try to counterbalance voices from abroad with really interesting poets from here too, which brings me to Ian Brand. In introducing him tonight, I'm sort of coming full circle because we met on a CLMP panel about 8 or 9 years ago. It was a panel to discuss little magazine distribution, which is always a fraught topic. It was especially fraught because one of the colleagues on the panel was a distributor who had never paid me, but which was kind of an interesting encounter, but it remained very civilized. We just never alluded to the fact that I had never gotten paid. So we just discussed it from a very lofty level of little magazine distribution. But I was very impressed at the time by Ian's knowledge of poetry. At that time, he was working in a bookstore. He knew an awful lot about poetry and poetry distribution. And at that time, I didn't know that he was also a gifted lyric poet. And that's what we're privileged to hear tonight. We published him as a reviewer, and we've also published him as a poet. He's written two Pushcart Prize nominated chapbooks of poetry, a brief bio of the Stick Figure, and the Ransack Planetarium. You can get them through Pudding House. They're really excellent books. And what I would say about his work, if I could summarize it, of course you'll hear it yourself, is that it's very spare, but it's at the same time, it's kind of gorgeous with metaphor. It's very metaphorically intricate and musical, which makes sense because Ian is also a jazz musician. He's a bass player, and I think of him sometimes as playing these sweet riffs of desolation, which are humorously despairing and despairingly humorous. So without any more ado, here's Ian.
Thank you very much, Phil, for that introduction. And I'm going to read some selections from that have been published in the Manhattan Review over the years first, about 4 or 5 poems. Let's see. This is called Say It. The fathers keep secrets so big, those secrets keep them from loved ones. The fathers vanish in the breast pocket of a secret so obvious, nobody in the family will say it, for fear such a secret will say them, thus making the family vanish like birthday candles, which darken selflessly in the service of one man's wish. This is called Rosaries. The cars are wearied beads stalled inside the woman's grip. Even her ambulance is a vertebrae strung upon a nerve. The siren ruminates over the major questions until the red light smears the faces of window shoppers whose heads turn away from their own mortality and float off again. Each head, the body's own balloon drifting away so the flesh may enjoy its thoughts from a distance. Like one stray salmon dying into the future, the ambulance crashes through wave after wave of recurring dream, makes an exit wound of hopelessness, until the paramedics are beyond fearing their vehicle may fishtail wildly in the drizzle, crash and splay the glittering instruments of survival, a box filled with rosary beads, the luminous row spilled into a world so prolific with loss, the odds are at least one being among us will breathe again. This is a short piece, it's called Idea. A lowercase x, no heavier than a mosquito wing, is hoisted up by one of the many arthritic arms of this antediluvian typewriter, which the homeless man now commences to play like Cecil Taylor. Exquisite chatter, so random and outside among the hammer blows of blessed rain. The apparitions of happy hour. A seed nurses a crush on sunlight. The grapevine is paid out far into the dark, creeps over to kiss the lit window as if the drooping tendril ached to purple anything's mind. The solitary grape bore a sour face before it came alive. Only the undead of happy hour are fluent in this garble of vegetation, clouds with mouths, the feely slurred speech of overreaching winos. Friends pluck secrets off each other's tongue at the speed of hummingbirds. All in all, I'm just a glowing residue, twilight in its cracked test tube dwindling brightly. This is a relatively new poem. It's called The Fly in the Bakery at Evening Time. Hunger revelates in the gloaming, alights upon a vanilla rosette, preens on a whipped cloud, dies and wakes in ever sweeter heavens, performs fly angels in the lemon cream, buzzes like a question above the bride and groom. I've been obsessed with insects lately in my poems. I don't know why. Anyone wants to take some stabs at it? Maybe there's a shrink in the audience that could help me with that. To all the flickering witnesses, being lost in the interstices of the double life, you can't decide which one holds more of you. Quiz the night and the stars demure like turn signals, though one blinkered firefly trapped between two window panes semaphores its storied life across a vast and desolate turnpike. Not for hope of rescue, not even to elegize, but to say to each flickering witness who happens by, how fast our lives, how cursory our dreaming, Let us be now and never or perish. This is called The Improvisers. It's sort of set in Times Square. Some casting agency must have burned down tonight. All the characters are free to improvise upon the rich and inexhaustible themes of poverty. A tourist tries to guess under which of the three walnut shells his brain could be. Tonight, the unredeemed glass slippers are recycled into the rasps of the lonesome. Mr. Prudhomme, if property is theft, the heart is better off homeless, because no one begging is without cause in this night court of victimless crimes. Not one plea of love is entirely unreal. Here's another insect poem called The Ontology of the Spider. Being trawls the void for other beings. No wonder death plucks the musculature of a cloud and life falls quiet as dusk, drains from the seed husks of their bodies as the spider's heart clots with the angry brake lights. The repeated flare and wane of red eyes facing away from the very future the hour crawls to. But our triangulating anti-hero invents loopholes slack enough for any moment to flitter through unscathed, eyes abuzz with possibility. 1,000 sight lines radiating out from the most infinitesimal will. Mr. Fly, you didn't give the spider a second thought, but your third makes him sway the way the mind shivers the candelabrum until thinking icily substantiates itself again. The crazed fracture extracted from a living jewel. Sort of another Times Square poem. It's called Interplanetary Homesickness. Outside the bus terminal, a man weeping into a payphone has reversed all the charges to Jupiter. His voice may go dead before it finds home through the static of his thoughts, while less remote companions may assemble a cardboard house to keep him warm. The taxicabs make fresh inroads into chaos theory as the jumbo television strobes across the awed and homesickly faces. We are all sad Lilliputians roving the square tonight. Our corporeal selves somnambulate under the microscope of so many alien desires. We've nearly set our bodies loose to run their mindless errands in the dark. This is called The Angel of History, and it's also set in New York at night. The Angel of History. Even a storefront mannequin longs to quit its night job, feel a pair of wings applaud a sonic boom of glitter, infinite conundrums of thread. I think she endeavors to smithereen our brittle hopes and arc above the entire honeycomb of windows, each windowed story shocked ablaze as she ascends. But for now, she's all tabula rasa, an armature arrayed with drippings of lace or snug in a feather boa, a dissipating smoke ring. The flimsiest belief she had a mouth to speak in tongues that we had incalculable ears to translate. But loneliness, my friends, has a scheme for every straw woman or man under a sun that punishes the meek with glee until the humble finally crash the light in all their peddled fineries. Money touches all and desires nothing. The face it displays has no eyes to ransack for love. And yet, like green digits tattooed upon the leaf of some endangered species, the doomed approximation of a face stares back at you. Extinction by extinction, loneliness has gerrymandered its own tiny empire here on Earth. The skeleton is marionette to a planetary whim. And in the street, the desolate are dancing a minuet with all the mannequins among downy stars of glass. These sparks, like dayflies, expire. What we've forgotten will even outlast history. I don't have any happy poems, I'm sorry. It just occurred to me. This isn't so bad, I guess. It's a sort of a meditation on winter. It's called Dumb Show. Now the grapevine, plucked clean outside my window, grows slack like the string on a warping violin. Autumn finds even the most unassuming leaf, and my cats, pasted to the glass, can already smell the birds fleeing the green lean-tos, know exactly how long before each song disappears from the tree's numberless menu, before winter unplugs the delicious jukebox of that tree. Across the way, in a brownstone, another feline is hovering like a pupil in the stunned eye of a window. Soon a truck will plow away the chalk dust of these words as the cars and hydrants and payphones finally flower into ghosts among the speechless. And I'm going to read, I think, just two more. Brief poems. This one's very brief. It's called Dream House. More insects. These spiders are the talkative hands of the draftsman, gesturing the dimensions of the dream house, a sketch rendered in midair, nearly enough to whisper in. Is it? Three journeys. The ants go out and return, real and unreal, one long quavering tape loop of barely audible munching sound. Micro farmers, a conveyor belt of beings with no end, hoofing bread crust and leaf over the cheekbones white as parchment. And while the skull erodes to the first draft of a face, the potato's spidery eyes begin their own journeys. Its peripatetic seeing outstares the least thing alive in us. Each eye pours out its very mind and molds another of its lumpen kind for fellowship, for hope, and love. Thank you very much.
Quickly, I'd like to thank the New York State Council for the Arts, a state agency, the New York City Department of Cultural Affairs, and National Endowment for the Arts for making this series possible. And the way you can help us to help them to continue to help us fund us is by filling out the little green surveys real quickly in front of you with the little golf pencils. They like to see that things are moving along. And also I'd like to thank Karen Giussone and the NYPL for hosting us in this beautiful room this entire time. Years we've been doing this now, and
It's great. And also the rest of the staff at CLMP, Jamie Schwartz, Jana Corbo, Jeffrey Leppendorf, without whom I wouldn't be able to stand on my own 2 feet. And without further ado, Elizabeth Hodges with the St. Petersburg Review.
I'd like to thank CLMP and the Public Library as well. This is a wonderful series, and we're grateful to be invited to be in it. Thank you. The St. Petersburg Review is an independent international review of contemporary literature. We publish poetry, fiction, plays, nonfiction. Anything else? Two of my associate editors here, Maria Gusev and Risa Albaher, in case you want to talk to them during the refreshments, and it's almost time for refreshments. The one thing I wanted to say about the St. Petersburg Review, it was sort of born out of the experience of being in a community of writers from other countries who are writing in other languages, and the lack of vehicles. There are some really wonderful vehicles for these writers, but they're few and far between. So at St. Petersburg Review, we have a goal of having at least 50%, or trying to have at least 50% of our publication be from people who are writing outside of the United States and in other languages. So, without saying, I could keep talking about St. Petersburg Review. I really think it's a great magazine. I'll tell you, we just learned that one of our writers in the second issue, an African writer, Parsalelo Kantai, was just shortlisted for the Kane Prize for African Literature in England. So we are really happy about that. We do have a website, stpetersburgreview.com. The press release that is on our news page is current, so if you want to find out more about us, please go there and read it. It's my great pleasure to introduce Ken Calhoun tonight. I could tell you many things about him. He's a videographer as well as a writer, multi-talented human being. He's assistant professor of interactive media at Elon University in North Carolina. Even more importantly, he was on Jewel's creative team for 4 years. Correct, 4 years? There is a video that he did on the Summer Literary Seminars website, if you would care to just go and look at his work. But by way of introducing him, I'm going to read a very short quote that was in Literary Magazine Review, and this is about the story that he's going to read tonight. And Corey J. Murray said, "My favorite story by far was Headlock by Kenneth Calhoun. In this kooky yet ultimately touching story, the writing is nearly flawless and balances nicely against the humor in the first half of the story." So that sets you up, Ken. Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Libby. It was very nice. And thank you, everyone, for coming. This story, as you just heard, is called Headlock, and it appeared in the very first issue of the St. Petersburg Review, which looks like this. All right. Let me try to get in character here, because this isn't me. This is some other guy. Headlock. Before I was to leave for the war zone, I was given the option to have an experimental collar installed. The collar was designed to discourage beheadings. It was similar to a neck brace that one would wear after suffering whiplash, though it had elements of an Elizabethan dog collar, which bloomed like a toilet bowl around a dog's head to prevent it from licking off ointments and lotions. Having seen a number of beheadings online, I thought this collar made a lot of sense. The experimental collar was called the headlock. It tightly ringed the neck and then opened outward under the chin. In the back, it rose up at near vertical angle, similar to the gular segments of a tortoise's plastron, and fluted slightly to cup the back of the head in the manner of marginal segments that rim a tortoise's shell. The collar had to be surgically installed. Two metal anchors embedded securely into the scapula, and the center post fused into the sternum. Intensive electrolysis on the chin, neck, and back of the head was highly recommended to avoid the discomforts of hair. At the push of a button located in the throat area, the collar secreted an aloe-based oil that cooled and soothed the skin under it, so any itchiness or irritation could be instantly relieved. I thought this collar made a lot of sense. Dana, my wife, thought it was a bit much, saying that it would restrict my ability to turn my head and therefore make me more vulnerable to capture. I tried to explain my position to her, relating the nightmares, the lurid fantasies that I had while jogging, which really brought up my heart rate. I reminded her of our trip to a psychic. It was her first birthday gift for me back when we were dating. The psychic was a middle-aged woman with a teenage boy's mustache. She read my cards, my palm, my eyes, and announced that I had lived many lives, one, incidentally, as a wastewater plant operator, hence my aversion to sewage. Some of those lives, she grimly explained, ended with the severe physical abuse and painful executions. This was the reason for my aversion to torture, the psychic told us. That woman was a fraud, Dana exclaimed, pointing out that the psychic had also predicted that we would not be married. Yet here we were with a rock band worth of babies on the way, the fetal Fab Four, as we sometimes called our unborn quadruplets. It was a logically sound argument. The only way to counter was to show her the beheading videos online, which I had bookmarked in a folder I had deceptively titled Turtle Sites, a subject she had tired of years ago, the topic that now repulsed her. We watched the victims, how they were just before the bread knife came out of the sleeve. I pointed out the knowing on their bloodless faces. We sat with them waiting, then felt the hardness of the dark, inescapable hands and the icy bite of the blade and the drowning screams. Two days later, I had the metal anchor surgically embedded. A day after that, I was wearing the collar. It was painful at first, and though it made it challenging to sleep, it did provide me with some peace of mind. It endowed me with a feeling of confidence, something like what I felt as a kid when I took judo for a couple weeks. By the time of my going away party, I'd gotten fairly used to the collar. We told most of the guests the true nature of the apparatus, but my wife and I decided not to divulge the purpose or its purpose to my mother, who was already extremely upset with the idea of me going to the war zone. She couldn't understand how I could even consider it, especially with babies on the way. The reason for going was simple: money. For one thing, we were going to need a Chevy Tahoe. We needed money, and the war zone needed electricians. We're going to have lots of babies, and it's not like you can give some away like a bag of extra apricots, I had told her over the phone. Well, I certainly wasn't suggesting that, she said defensively, always so serious. It was all life and death with her. She was against the use of fertility drugs. Now here she was, bringing it up again in the festive glow of tiki torches as I worked the grill and the sky feathered up, wet and orange. I scraped meat crumbs from the grill. They're paying a lot of money to people willing to go to the war zone, I said. Unbelievable money. Well, that's because people are getting killed there all the time. Not all the time, I argued. The odds are pretty slim. You're more likely to be bitten by a viper while sitting on a toilet. You don't know. You know only what they tell you, and they don't tell it all, she said, once again applying her suspicions of an alliance between the media and the government. She was a hippie, my mother, a long time ago in dress and now in spirit. She would never stand during the national anthem at ball games. She hated Dow, the company. She hated companies. My father, who had been dead for nearly 10 years, was still her co-conspirator. They acted as if war was a terrible disease or a child molester, and anyone who wanted it was shit on the shoe of an angel. They simply refused to see the opportunities. When she showed up at the party, we told her I had whiplash. Her initial response was one of delight, saying, well, I suppose this means you're not going, that you're going to stay here where you belong with your wife who is with children. I explained that it did not mean that at all, flipping turkey burgers as we talked. Well, how can you do your job like that, she cried, and to demonstrate her point, she stood in my blind spot and threw uncooked wieners at my head. You're wasting food, I said. Don't even try to use my own ethics against me, you dumb shit, she shouted. Maybe she was drunk. It had happened before. She stormed off into the black trees, no doubt intending to pout by the turtle pond. I started after her, but was blocked by my neighbor, Gail the Whale, who wanted to dance. Her husband Lim was already dancing with my wife. The boombox was blasting, and people, my friends, were gyrating on the patio in the carnival flicker of colored Christmas lights. Their stretched shadows played like a mob of gentle monsters against the stucco wall of my house. "But my mother," I said to Gail the whale. She wouldn't hear of it, dragging me onto the floor. I did what I could, but the collar was limiting my movements. "Loosen up, man," Lim said. "You're so stiff." Well, that got a laugh. I got an even bigger one when I did the robot in response. We line danced, and the collar actually seemed to help. Then I was hit with a fistful of potato salad. I turned to face my attacker, but my mother, who had returned from her sulk, stayed in my blind spot, orbiting outside my periphery like the dark side of the moon. I took another hit to the ear and managed to spin the opposite way and grab her arm, knocking the bowl of potato salad to the ground. "What are you doing, mother?" I yelled. The salad in my ear forced me to hear myself. The dancing was doused. Someone shut the music off. She tried to tear her arm away, staring at me with contempt. She was a black belt, but in her drunken state, she couldn't pull off any of her fancy escape maneuvers. I gave her a good shake. "What the hell are you doing, you crazy psycho?" "Woody," my mom said. "You don't deserve that name," my mother screeched. "Don't call him that." They had named me after Woody Guthrie, a hippie singer who loved migrant workers. My mother had more to say. "You're nothing but a profiteer. How do we raise a war profiteer, Clyde?" She was talking to my dead father now, looking heavenward, where surely he must have taken up post-life residence. There was potato salad down the collar. I was digging after it when my mother threw herself at me, sobbing, pounding at my chest and clawing at my eyes, but now lovingly. "You kids," she blubbered, "I hate what you've become, a bunch of soulless husks wearing your rectum like a ski mask." Wow, I thought, definitely drunken, maybe on dope too. It was so irritating, ruining the party vibe with one of her generational comparison rants that I'd been hearing all my life. After all, if everything was so screwed up, wasn't it her generation that let it get that way? Why do we have to not only apologize for their orgy, but also sleep on their wet spot? At any rate, she seemed to have gotten it out of her system with her outburst. She threw her arms around me, wailing. "I'm sorry," she said. "I'm so sorry. I don't know what I'm doing." And when she tried to bury her face into my neck, she chipped the front of her tooth on the Kevlar. Fortunately, Lim is a dentist. He took her into the house and had a look. My friends and I and my wife, everyone, we could only shrug. Just the emotion of it all, we told each other. Her son is going to the war zone and her daughter-in-law is having quadruplets. People's heads are being sawed off online with bread knives. Plus she's drunk and probably high on weed, a nasty old habit she had. And she and my dad had shared. I apologized to everyone personally for my mother's behavior. I regretted that the party had come to an end on such a negative note. It acknowledged that there was no way to get things back on track. We all agreed that a distraught mother, even a hippie one, is a guaranteed buzzkill. We said our goodbyes, standing at the end of our front yard path, where we could say something personal to each and every guest as they filed by. They touched or nodded at my wife's belly, saying sweet things to the little street gang that lived in there. And they asked me about my turtles, who's going to take care of them for me. The neighbor kids had volunteered, I explained. I can't keep them away. If you can't beat them, hire them. Take care of yourself was their general message to me. Stay safe. And my message to them was a promise to do just that. When I come back, I assured them we'll have another party, a much bigger one. A lot bigger, since by then my little platoon of children will have marched into the light of day. Dane and I went in to check on my mother. Lim had given her some painkillers, and she was out cold in a nursery we had prepared for our litter. She was sleeping in a sitting position, occupying the special four-baby nursing chair in all her slumped-over milklessness. I pushed back her upper lip to a snarl and looked at the chipped tooth. A small triangle was missing from the bottom of her top right front tooth, and a crack ran vertically upward, under the gum line. "Looks like the Liberty Bell," I said. "Did you wash your hands?" Lim asked. "Probably should if you're going to handle her lip that way." I thought about that missing little triangle of tooth, and how it was now just like a little shark's tooth out there in the world. Or maybe she had swallowed it. Its absence left a little notch, and it occurred to me my mother could now probably remove carpenter nails with her tooth, which was now slightly forked at the like a claw end of a hammer. This thought led me to an image of her removing the nails from a birdhouse, which led to a memory of my father's obscenely simple casket. I thought of my mother pulling nails from my father's cheap casket with her teeth. Before Lim had left, he mentioned that my mother's gums in the area immediately above the tooth were bruised and that she would probably require a pulpectomy, what's commonly referred to as a root canal, though the root canal is the area to be addressed and not the name of the procedure. Any little fissure in a tooth, he explained, would invite bacteria, which could lead to jawbone infection. First, though, the infection will result in an abscess and probably a fistula, which was basically a channel created by the pressure of accumulating pus. It finds its way out, finds its own way out, makes its own opening. Wow, I thought. I thought about someone with blocked vas deferens. Would the sperm create a fistula? Would there be a... That would be pretty wild to have sperm weeping out of a hole in your thigh. I was thankful for my problem. I was thankful that my problem, or our problem, had nothing to do with blocked vas deferens. While she's getting the root canal, she might as well have the tooth capped, Lim recommended. Wow, I said, poor old lady. I felt badly, but I couldn't help remind myself that it was all her own doing. What was she thinking anyway? It was a curious injury. And it occurred to me that had I not been wearing the headlock collar, her tooth may have penetrated my neck. It's entirely possible that she could have slashed my jugular. She loved gays, my porcupine mother, which was strange because none of her kids were gay. She really deeply loved gays and brain-dead hippies. And it seemed to us, when we looked at how she spent her spare time, holding them against her soft belly, giving the rest of us quills. Would I leave her alone with the babies? Maybe only until they could talk, or until they could clearly understand human language. Then she would have to be watched so that she didn't pass on her unhappiness in the things she says. She can be with them, I might have to say, but only after taking a vow of silence. After Lim left, we decided to go for a walk instead of cleaning up after the party. We went out the back door, across the patio, down through the trees. The dark woods crowded around us. Fireflies drifted by, flaring up like bits of blown-on charcoal. Ahead through the trees, the pond was slick. It was a slick, dark place pulling down what light it could from the sky. We held hands and sat on a bench overlooking the obsidian smear. Dana took my hand and put it on her belly, which was really starting to expand. I held it there, hoping to feel those pups squirming around, maybe playing a round of tennis doubles. Turns out they were well into a game of two-on-two hoops. I leaned over and peeped in through her navel so I could call the game. It was skins versus skins, so it was tough to tell them apart. They're all boys, so that didn't help. And bald. Because of this, it was hard to tell who won and who lost, which means they're all winners, Dana said. And losers, I added. Dana frowned. She insisted on positive thinking, whereas I was more comfortable with the yin-yang of things. That's what happens when you have hippie parents. You inherit some of the craziness. To change the subject, I patted the bench and gave Dana a wink. I had built the bench for turtle watching, and it was on this bench that the quadruplets were conceived one night, nearly 5 months earlier, from sexing in a supposedly ineffective sitting position after Dana had been so completely moved by one of my responses. It was a role-playing game that we had started with soon after I came up with the idea of working in the war zone so we could afford a baby, back when we were trying to get pregnant. The sex had become pretty mechanical, and we were looking for ways to keep it interesting. The game always started with Dana grabbing a fistful of hair and pulling my head back. Using an insurgent's accent, she would whisper, "Tell me why it is I should not kill you, American scum." My responses were, at first, were typical, obvious, and nothing life-sparing. I meant them no harm. I was just trying to make a living. I had no feelings of animosity toward them, and I wished them well. It was nothing personal. I mean, I didn't even know them, and I was willing to give them the benefit of the doubt. I was just in the wrong place at the wrong time. If they were to let me go, I would leave the country and not tell anyone anything that might give away their position. I would say they were decent, desperate people, and that they fed me well and provided clean towels, even if they hadn't. I would also tell them that I'm a simple man who just wants to live my life in peace. I would tell them about my turtles and my interest in terrapins and my collection. I would tell them that some humans are turtles, like myself, only wanting to live inside a snugly fitted home, to move slowly through life so as to savor it, and to respond to all threats and offenses passively, simply by pulling in my arms and legs and my head to wait out the danger. I would convince them of my turtle outlook, my personal philosophy inspired by a creature from which we can all learn so much. I would show them pictures of Fickle Frank and Sloopy and Wetback and Lil Lesbo and Michelle and all the gang at the pond. Those are some names. That night, the night we conceived the kids, I was telling the insurgent who was my wife about my turtles when I saw the hurt in her eyes, the hurt at having to talk about turtles. I had taken advantage of the game, using her assumed identity to talk about something she had forbidden me to talk about. I was losing this insurgent. It wasn't looking good. At any minute, the bread knife could emerge from under the insurgent's blouse. I thought of something new to tell the insurgent. It was a thing I should have said all along. It was the only thing that could possibly save me. Instead of talking about my turtles, I told the insurgent about my sweet, wonderful wife and her desire for a family and my failure to inseminate her. Who wouldn't be moved by the situation? It was a universal hardship, though all the more moving when you knew my wife, the kindest, most loving person in the world, a person who could who'd really make a great mom, insurgent, a super terrific mom. As I was saying this, I felt the insurgent loosen her grip on my hair, and I knew I was on to something. She grew up an only child, I told the insurgent, a sweet, lonely kid playing alone in a small backyard. Her parents both worked, so she spent a lot of time on the tire swing, just swinging and watching the fruit fall from the tree. Now the insurgent was tearing up a little. I mentioned to the insurgent that the child had an unfortunate mole, and she wished with all her might it would dry up. And the insurgent's hand went to the corner of her lip where there was a mole. I went on. This little girl, insurgent, grew up to be a quietly beautiful teenage girl who, in her desperation for love and approval, tried out for cheerleader but didn't make it and had to settle for drill team, which was also known as the dog squad. She dated a lot of guys who turned out to be jerks. They were obsessed with her breasts, which were big, especially back when her body was so small. Her breasts, insurgent, were famous at her school. Boys came around and that's all they wanted, to touch them and to suck them and lick them and to squeeze them and rub and twist the nipples like knobs on an Etch-a-Sketch. The insurgent sobbed at that, releasing my hair. But I had to go on. It had to be an unconditional surrender. I would settle for nothing less than a car ride back to the embassy, so to speak. So the girl went to college, I told the insurgent, at her parents' insistence, took a degree in liberal studies, earning a teaching credential, even though she was much more interested in urban studies and planning. And there she dated more jerks, especially a guy named Mark Jenkins who didn't respect her tastes, taking her to a lot of action movies and Chinese buffets, even though she explained that Chinese was too greasy for her stomach. She lost her virginity to some frat guy just to hurt Mark Jenkins, which is no way to start your life as a sexually active adult. And there was no taking it back. When your virginity is gone, it's gone forever. For that reason, you should give it only to someone very special and for the right reasons. The insurgent looked up and frowned. I had gone too far, it seemed. An old argument had made a cameo appearance, and that was wrong. I backed off. My wife, I told the insurgent, is that girl I've been telling you about. A great teacher, a good cook and shopper, a fine companion, a woman who married me, a pretty fantastic guy despite some motility issues, a woman who bought a house with me and allowed me to have a study and a pond so long as it was away from the house so that mosquitoes wouldn't be a problem, even though I explained that terrapins love mosquito larvae, a woman who was extremely happy until her sister had had a baby and she went to visit the baby, and when she came back, she said, "Everywhere I look, I see babies." She saw them on TV, and she saw them in both the ads and the shows. And they were in cars driving by. They were in shopping carts and strapped on to both men and women on the jogging trails. She was a woman without a baby in a baby-crazy culture, I told the insurgent. Now, it's all she thinks about, and her husband, me, a great guy otherwise, can't give her one without the use of fertility drugs. She has the nursery all planned out and names for both genders. She goes on a lot of parenting websites and lurks on message boards. Just lurking, lurking, never posting on her own. She says she's incomplete without the baby. She says it's like living with half a heart. She's a beautiful, wonderful woman who deserves anything she wants, and I will die trying to give it to her, insurgent. At this point, now nearly 5 months ago, the insurgent looked me in the eyes. We stared at each other as the owls hooted nearby. The insurgent's eyes were wet with tears behind her big glasses. I was smiling, knowing I had a good chance of being released, that if I played my cards right, it would be all over soon. The insurgent leaned forward and kissed me on the mouth, on the neck. The insurgent undid my pants and took me out of my new plaid boxer shorts that the doctors recommended I wear. The insurgent pushed me back and straddled me, pulling her panties aside. The insurgent was so turned on. The insurgent started sliding and grinding, all the while kissing my eyes and chewing lightly at my mouth. This was an intense insurgent, a super horny insurgent, an unstoppable insurgent. To keep myself from submitting to her demands, I imagined the ride in the car. To the embassy. Seeing the streets teeming with people who don't know me or care about my fate, I envision the back of the driver's head, the hairy earlobes as he steers through the jammed streets. I see the embassy in the distance. The driver pulls to the side of the street. "You can exit the car here," he says. "You'll have to walk yourself to the rest of the way to the embassy." "I understand. No problem," I say. "Thanks for everything." I open the door and walk quickly through the street, passing vendors and shops and men playing cards and drinking tea, and there are lots of flies and vulgar cuts of meat. Just as I get to the embassy door, I feel freedom rising, but I hold it off until I push through the embassy entryway and I shout, "I am free!" Now the bench bore the fruit of that night, supporting with its back my wife and the four future people inside her, plus me and my Kevlar collar, which wasn't as light as it looked. I felt her grip tighten around my hand, and she said, "Is there no other way, Woody?" "Please," I said. "It's all in motion." I knocked on the collar. She started in with, "If anything should happen to you." "What could happen?" "A lot worse things." "Like what?" "You don't know because you don't cook," she said cryptically. I didn't want to talk about it. "Let's go to the pond," I suggested. "I want to say bye to the gang." "Oh, baby. Don't. All this crying. You'll see." "There are so many nice people who want white babies," she said. "I just saw a show about it on Oprah." "Boy, I wish Oprah would give us a Chevy Tahoe," I said. "She tends to give Pontiacs." We held hands in the woods on the bench where we conceived quadruplets. I should have stayed right there. I should have be sitting there to this day with my wife, refusing to let the future itself happen, just holding the woman that would offer her up our children to strangers if it kept me from harm. It was a moment you could tolerate for an eternity. After a while, my wife told me to go say my goodbyes to the turtles. "Go do it alone," she said. "You should have your privacy." Besides, she explained that she was feeling very heavy and worried that she would slip on the steep bank and fall into the black water. The dancing had taken a toll on her legs. I stood and told her to wait there. "It won't take long, and we'll be back to the house. We'll go walk back up to the house together." I walked down the trail to the water, shaky and sullen. My eyes had adjusted, and I was able to pick my way down the bank. I could see the dark form of my reflection in the glassy, still water. The water looked thick and gooey. Lily pads formed a pattern of what appeared to be holes in the slick surface. I made my way around to the shell back in. This was a simple structure I'd created on the end of the pond, a low lean-to over the mud that the turtles use as a nightly shelter. I'd built in a black light and a webcam so I can check in on them from my office. Now I intended to watch them from the war zone if given internet access and time. I would see that if they were being cared for by the neighbor boys that I had deputized as surrogate guardians. I lifted the top of the shell back, which I had built on hinges so I could access the terrapins without kneeling on the damp ground. There they were, dutifully clumped, half burrowed in the black mud. Boy, I was feeling emotional. I rested my hand on each of their backs, conveying my simple message through my pulse, which was this: I'm alive and you are alive at the same time, and that's what binds us. They were safe, yet vulnerable, blood-filled stones, armored, prehistoric, yes, but so absolutely dependent on order in the world, an order that persisted well enough for millions of years, but who knows? I sat on the edge of the structure and watched them do nothing for a while. In such a vacuum of expression, the slightest gesture is a ballet. I could hear Dana sniffling up in the darkness, still crying a little bit. It rattled me. I knew I would recall it later, the sound of her weeping in the dark woods, my mother unconscious in the nursing chair with a chipped tooth, war, I shivered as the word blew through me. An unsettling hole was opening up before me, a jagged mouth in the universe. At the very least, it was good to have the collar at my throat. But even better, I thought, would be skin made of bone. That's the end. Thanks.
Thanks again, everyone. Please join us out in the hall for some refreshments. And we'd like to see you back here on May 30th for the Megathon reading. And if not then June 9th for the next periodically speaking. Thanks again.